Devoncast
from Radio X.
This is Devoncast, your weekly helping of news and views from Devon for Devon. I'm Alison Stevenson and I'm joined for this episode by Guy Henderson. How's the east of the county looking today, Guy?
Pretty good, pretty bright at the moment, although we have a yellow warning for thunderstorms tonight, so things could get a little bit stormy.
Oh, it's very changeable at the moment, isn't it? So in this Devoncast, we're not talking about the elections, but we're recording this before the polls take place. That's because you and I are going to be frantically busy on Thursday this week and probably sound asleep on Friday. So we're parking the elections for a week. Instead, we have news of Exeter Pride, a rallying call for railways in Tavistock, a delicious devolution dish, and a chat with a woman who has one of Devon's most important jobs, overseeing the £500 million a year tourism industry on the English Riviera. This is Devoncast from Radio X and the Local Democracy Reporting Service. It's available on the Radio X website from your usual podcast provider and from the all-new Devoncast Radio on DAB Digital Radio.
First, Exeter Pride is back. After a year's absence, the event makes a comeback on the 11th of May with a packed programme, which includes a march, a market and Morris Men, among many other highlights. Our reporter Honey 40 has been talking to Russell Adam of Exeter Pride to find out more.
Exeter Pride returns this year, which we're really, really excited for, on the 11th of May. So sadly, it did have to be cancelled last year due to sort of just a few issues with volunteers and getting people involved, and the committee just shrunk really small. But this year we're in such a good position and we're so excited to be back. So the main thing that I think people really missed was the march. So we made sure that's a really important part of Exeter Pride this year. So we're going to be having our usual big march up starting at St Sidwell's. Meeting around 11:30 and the march starts at 12. They're going all the way down the main High Street, centre of Exeter, and then down through Queen Street and then into Northern Hay Gardens. So we're really, really excited to be back this year.
And how are we more prepared this year than we were last year?
Oh, just beaming thinking about it at the moment. So we're in such a good position now, which is great. So volunteers wise, we've got over 90 odd volunteers that are now all signed up, that have done all their training already and really keen to get involved, which is just brilliant. So we need a lot of volunteers to make Pride happen every single year, as well as the money and the support that we need. It's a lot of people power that's needed about the community coming together. And there's just been a massive outpouring of that help and support this year, which is brilliant. So sort of Pride not going ahead last year has been a bit of a catalyst to sort of get people realising that it doesn't just happen without people actually coming forward and supporting. So our committee, for example, loads of us all came forward this year because it didn't happen last year. And it's just made a massive growth in Exeter Pride. And yeah, we're in a brilliant position now to get it going for the 11th of May.
How can people get in touch if they'd like more information or see how they can help?
Yeah, so the main way is through our socials. So on Instagram, it's just Exeter Pride, and same thing with Facebook, just Exeter Pride. So they're the main ways that we sort of ping information out. We've also got a mailing list, and it's really important if people sign up to that, because we've had sadly quite a lot of storeholders and other people that want to get involved and perform, but because we're just a month away, we're all full, I'm afraid. So if you sign up to our mailing list, and that's just on our website, so if you just Google Exeter Pride and then go down to the bottom, we've got a mailing list there. We've had a lovely big rebrand as well this year, so it's our sort of 15 years anniversary, so we're celebrating 50 years of protest in Exeter, and so we've had a massive rebrand, so we've got all new logos, all new branding and a brilliant new website as well, so people go along and have a look at it and sign up to our mailing list.
Tell us more about the day itself, like specific happenings, like the march, for example.
Brilliant. So yeah, the march is starting at 12 o'clock. It'll be moving off, people starting to congregate from 11:30, just sort of at top of St Sidwell Street, outside of the community centre and Monkey Suit up there. So come along from 11:30 and grab some merch as well, because we'll be set up in the Monkey Suit with all of our new t-shirts, hoodies, tote bags, you name it. Pop along and grab some of our new merch. And then we'll be going all the way down the main High Street. There's going to be Samba Band performing. We've got Morris dancers there as always. We're going to have some lovely tunes blaring out from Radio X as well. But yeah, so lots of entertainment. And then that goes all the way down into Queen Street and feeds into Northern Hay Gardens, where we'll be having our marketplace all set up, as well as lots of other fun things for all the family to get involved in.
And why is Pride important to a city like Exeter?
Yeah, well, it's so important, especially to somewhere like Exeter. So I'm myself a teacher and teacher in a rural school just around the local area. And we were absolutely gutted when Pride wasn't happening. So we wanted to come together and bring our LGBTQ+ group to walk together in the march. Because obviously being in a rural community, there's not really that sort of opportunities for those students and those individuals. So Exeter sort of being a catchment area for all the sort of local groups and local areas to come together is really, really important. The population of Exeter that's LGBTQ+ is actually 10.3%, which is absolutely massive. Just a bit of context on that. Nationally, it's about 2%. London 12, obviously a lot higher, absolutely fine, but we're on par with Brighton, that's 10.7%. So we've got a very, very large population here that identifies LGBTQ+, and it's really important that all of those are seen, they're heard, and known, they're loved and accepted by Exeter as well. It's a really inclusive city, it's a brilliant city. We want to make sure we all come together to show that everyone is loved, everyone is welcomed here. This year we really want to focus on green agenda, so thinking about making sure that this is the most environmentally friendly Pride ever, so making sure that we've got proper recycling points going on in Pride, and litter pickers, and green team, and that sort of stuff, as well as reusable water bottles. But we also want to really focus on making sure that this was a family-friendly event as well. So we're going to be doing completely alcohol-free in Northern Hay Gardens, which is a new thing for Pride, so we want to make sure people are aware of that. But again, it's just to make sure that is a safe space, it is an inclusive space. So there's going to be mocktails, there's going to be family-friendly events, there's going to be flag-making workshops, banner-making workshops. You can do things like self-love portrait club. There's going to be dance workshops, singing workshops, absolutely loads going on. And we've got some brilliant stuff from the Exeter University as well with Section 28. So they're going to be doing a collaging making workshop, looking back through lots of previous literature about Section 28, learning the history about it, and educating people about that. So there is so much going on the day. They're going to be spread out across Northern Hay Gardens, Phoenix, the Ram and the library, as well as lots of the fun entertainment heading on to the evening as well, and our partners and all the bars and clubs and Exeter as well. So something for everyone.
Thank you so much, Russell. It's been lovely speaking with you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
That was Russell Adam from Exeter Pride talking to our reporter Honey Forty.
Meanwhile, in Tavistock, a rallying call to put pressure on the government to build the railway line to Plymouth at speed has been made to more than 200 residents who attended a public meeting last week. The government confirmed £150 million for the project in last year's autumn statement, subject to an updated business plan being approved, but it could be 2029 before it's built. Rail campaigners say the work is simple in rail terms, as it involves laying 5 miles of track to Bir Alston and could just take a few months. But the rest of the track is in place to Plymouth, so it's not too difficult, they say. There are no compulsory purchase orders to be made, no tunnels or viaducts to be built. It's phase two of a bigger plan to get a resilient Northern Route mainline from Plymouth to Exeter, avoiding the South Devon coast. With a general election in the next few months and a potential change in government, the people of Tavistock want to know the money is both safe and spent quickly before costs escalate. Leader of the campaign group Tavi Rail, Richard Seawright, says the community needs to keep up the pressure.
You have to keep at it. I've been doing this for 10 years and things, unless you keep pushing away, reminding people, ringing them up, they do slip down the list very easily. These are very busy people. But if they know, oh, he's going to ring up again, you know. There is cross-party support for this. They know to resist this is suicide. You know, I can't imagine any MP not wanting to ally themselves. When our meeting in the autumn was delayed by our dear Queen dying, but to that, 4 MPs were coming, one of whom was a minister. So the 4 MPs were the different parties. And anyway, she died. It's so sad. But we had to cancel it.
And why is it so important to you that this line comes back?
I think it will be as successful as Oakhampton and crucial to the development of the town. But above all, an extra is, of course, the Oakhampton to Tavistock link, which converts us from a branch line to a main line, and actually probably a more resilient main line than Plymouth. When Dawlish went down, the business loss as a result of the peninsula, the whole of the southwest, not having a railway, is estimated at around about £1 billion, which is equivalent to the money that it would cost to restore our entire northern route. And you know, it would be secure and safe for future.
Okay, so in the great scheme of things, then, it's not that much?
No, it's really cheap. It's 2 miles of HS2. And that is what our entire line would cost, 2 miles of HS2. Because the track bed is laid, the viaducts are built, the tunnels are born, you know, all they've got to do is put track on it. And, it is really a very good value project. Mm. Lots of bang for buck.
That was Richard Seawright, who's leading the push for the Tavistock to Plymouth Railway. Now, this rail line has attracted the interest of Britain Remade, a cross-party campaign group lobbying to make it easier to get infrastructure, new homes and transport links in this country. The group, which is supporting projects in the West and North because it says for too long the government has concentrated on London and the South East, organised a meeting in Tavistock and says it will be campaigning in Westminster on behalf of the town. Here's campaign director Sam Richards, who used to be a special advisor at Number 10.
We as a country have become very bad at building the infrastructure that we need. In France, it costs 9 times less to build high-speed rail than it is currently costing us to build HS2. In Germany, rail electrification costs 3 times less than it is costing us to electrify our railways. This is because we wrap up our buildings in red tape, endless reams of paperwork before spades actually get in the ground. We want to cut the red tape to make it easier to build. And if we can streamline the environmental impact assessments and the planning processes, then we can make it cheaper to build new railway lines like the one here in Tavistock.
We heard that to make it all happen could take 5 months, but planning it is going to take 5 years. That's really frustrating for people here tonight. You can see that. So how are you going to lobby? How are you going to try and get that done sooner?
We totally share their frustrations. This is why we're going to be taking that back to London and making the case directly to ministers. The community here are very fortunate that they have got this brilliant campaign in Tavi Rail, and we're going to be working closely with them to make sure that local voices are heard and the political heat remains on politicians in Westminster to get this done.
Sam Richards there talking about keeping the heat on for the Tavistock Railway. With congestion on the road network, the 30-minute trip into the city by train will be a popular choice by many. Are you going to use that?
I think I will. I mean, I do. I like a trip on the train, Ali, if it's possible. But, I mean, we all remember when the rail line at Dawlish collapsed under the weight of the storms. It's 10 years ago now, isn't it? It's a long, long time ago.
Yeah.
And that kind of showed up how vulnerable the coast road is. But is a Northern line really feasible? Can you still? I mean, I know you can get to Okehampton. You can get from Tavi to Plymouth. But joining the dots between Tavistock and Okehampton is a major project, isn't it?
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, I think the kind of stumbling block in it is Maldon Viaduct. You know, it's possibly not able to cope with trains. They may have to put another crossover there, or that's the kind of the main bit, really. I think the rest of it is fairly simple. And I think there's a whole part of Devon that would use that and North Cornwall. So it would, you know, there's already people from like the Bude area. They go to Okehampton to catch the train. And obviously it'd be much quicker, really. A lot of people drive to Exeter or Tiverton from the West Devon area to get up further up in the country, because going to Plymouth is like going in and coming out again, if you see what I mean. So I think it would be really well used. And obviously people are talking about it being more resilient, because that coastal railway, there's still a lot of question marks over that, isn't there? With the changes in the weather, the storms were becoming more frequent, you know, it could still be quite a liability.
It could. And also there's some rolling stock that just can't cope with bad weather on that line. There are certain kinds of trains that have, I don't know very much about trains. Honestly, I'm not a train spotter, but they have kind of an open section on the top, which when the waves just come in and swamp the engine or something like that, much more technical than that. Oh. But there are certain types of train that can't run along that Dawlish line when the weather's really bad.
Right.
So it's, and as we move into the future, then, you know, public transport has to be at the forefront of people's thinking with climate change. So
I think so.
Yeah, maybe it's a goer.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one line in and out seems a little bit archaic, doesn't it?
It does.
So, let's hope it all gets joined up. We'll get the Tavistock to Plymouth bit done first and see where we go then.
Ali, let's talk devolution. Devolution, Devon County Council and Torbay Council have now voted comprehensively, conclusively, to join in the devolution deal. But last night it was all about food, glorious food. The council voted, as I say, unanimously last night. It means the two councils will set up a combined county authority, which they say will give them a seat at the table where generous helpings of government money are ladled out. Some of our district councils, on the other hand, say they have serious misgivings. But at Torbay Council last night, as captured here via the council's excellent YouTube channel, leader David Thomas explained how it all might work.
So what is devolution? Well, typically it refers to the decentralisation of powers and decision-making from national government to a more local level. Across Torbay and Devon, devolution will see the establishment of a combined county authority. It is important to emphasise that this is not a merger of two councils. This is not a local government reorganisation. This is effectively a deal between two primary councils whereby government will devolve down new powers and the money for those powers to the combined county authority. And it is this CCA that will have the power to make those decisions at a local level, thus removing part of the bid process that has been around for various pots of money, particularly around those new powers. Our combined aims in this first round seek to provide the people who live and work in Devon and Torbay to be better connected, more competitive, and more prosperous. We want to create more learning opportunities, construct new homes, foster local business growth, and improve our public transportation system and roads.
But the rest of the council, it was getting late in the day after all, the rest of the council must have been hungry because the food analogies quickly followed. Here's Liberal Democrat group leader Steve Darling.
It isn't looking at what's on the table at the moment. At the moment, we've got the starter, and it's quite thin pickings for what the amount of effort that we've had to put in to drive this forward. But one would hope that the main course over the horizon will be a much better meal than we have before us at the moment.
And here's his deputy, Swithin Long.
If this meagre gruel can lead to a more substantial meal later, then I think we should go for it.
Hungry councillors all round. That was Torbay Council debating the devolution deal last night.
That's making me feel like it's quite hungry, like it's lunchtime. 1:30. Devoncast comes from Radio X and the Local Democracy Reporting Service is available on the Radio X website from your usual podcast provider and from the all-new Devoncast Radio on DAB Digital Radio.
Now, I caught up with the elusive Caroline Custerson for a special feature on tourism in Torbay. She's elusive because she's so busy getting out there and spreading the good word about the bay that it took us a few goes to actually sit down and chat, but it was well worth it in the end. Caroline is the chief executive of the English Riviera Bid Company, which oversees tourism and marketing for the Bay. It's a kind of a cooperative made up of subscribing businesses, all with the same goal, that of promoting the Bay, bringing in as many visitors as possible. Now, our chat was so wide ranging that we're going to split it in two. Next week, we'll talk about the air show, stand-up paddleboards and Agatha Christie. But this week, we talk about the nuts and bolts of what makes Torbay tourism tick and how the trade has recovered from the pandemic. I started by asking how things were looking ahead of the new season.
I think the prospects are all totally dependent on the weather forecast. We have an amazing product here across the English Riviera. We've got 22 miles of spectacular coastline, a lot of it southwest coast path. We've got more attractions than any other UK resort, and we've got an incredible range of accommodation. So if you were thinking about a British holiday by the sea, by the coast, the product is here. The food and drink offering is also superb. We've got a transport all linked up, one of the best coastal bus services in the country. In fact, the number 12 bus, I was told, an interesting thing, is the busiest route that Stagecoach operate anywhere.
Really?
Yeah, so that was quite just a little bit of a snippet of these things I learn on my days when I'm here. So the prospect should be brilliant. But the one ingredient that determines whether people jump on a staycation and stay in the UK rather than perhaps taking a holiday overseas. But there's two factors, but I believe the biggest factor is the weather, and it's the weather forecast. So coming back to the prospect for this summer, the long-term forecast is very good. And I was told this by some of the restaurants in Brixham last week who said, don't worry, Caroline, about what happened at Easter, because the long-term weather forecast for the summer is that we're potentially going to see the hottest summer on record. The Easter was end of March. Next year, Easter is April the 22nd, a month later. It was cold. It was wet. And I think what we're seeing is that people have put off booking maybe a family break at Easter and are now booking for May half term. So we are predicting a very busy May half term, which dovetails the air show at the end as well. So it's a, you know, if we get that sunshine over those 10 days, then I think we're going, the prospects are better than what they have been. So yeah, I am much more optimistic now I've got sight of that long-term weather forecast, because I know the weather forecast can change and we can't stop people getting on an aeroplane and going abroad, but predominantly people tend to go abroad for the weather. So, and what's making me feel optimistic is that the late booking trend is so late now that a lot of people they may have booked time off work, but they've not yet booked where they're going. They haven't decided on the destination. So whether it's going to be staycation or whether it's going to be abroad. And I think as soon as we start to see this long-term forecast for the hottest summer on record coming out, it may stop some people going abroad. That's my theory anyway.
Now, if you cast your mind back a year or two, in the aftermath of the pandemic, the buzzword was staycation. People couldn't go abroad, or they just didn't fancy it. So there was a boom in holidays at home. The UK market did well, and Torbay did well with it. But a little while ago, there were stories doing the rounds that the days of the staycation are over. I asked Carolyn Custerson.
I think staycation is as important as it was back. Now, what we have to remember is the year at the end of COVID when nobody could travel abroad. So it was almost a forced staycation put across the whole population of the UK. But it sort of really brought home for people the chances to explore other areas. Staycation is still a very, very, very strong prospect. And the reasons I say that is we're seeing significant, if you break down your marketplace, you've got different, obviously, age groups, demographics, where people are traveling from. But we've seen a significant growth in group travel. So group bookings are really buoyant at the moment into the Bay. And a lot of it is because people are living longer. And then they maybe don't want to drive, or they're too nervous to drive post-COVID. So these aren't necessarily just budget coach operators. These are people who would prefer to take a door-to-door service and not have to drive themselves hundreds of miles in their own car or whatever. So that's going really well. I think there is family market, particularly preschool, family age market, who will always prefer potentially UK staycation when the little ones aren't quite ready to get on an aeroplane and all the, hassle attached to it. And then I think it's the younger actives, maybe the 18 to 34-year-olds that potentially are those that are more adventurers, they're explorers, and we're never going to pin them down to a staycation. They may take a staycation as part of their overall holiday programme for a year, but they are going to be people who want to pop on to New Zealand, go to Mexico. They are a generation, is this the Z generation, who have just got this ambition to travel the world. So as they come up through into being older, with be interesting how when they have families, what their mix of holidays are. So, but the staycation per se is very strong, and the 50 plus market, so the baby boomer staycation generation, are the strongest prospect for this country right now. We've got more people were born mid-50s to mid-60s than any other generation. They're a generation that now have got more money because a lot more people own their own houses. They may still be partly working, so they've got disposable income. And when I spoke to the investors for one of the hotel groups that have expanded recently in the Bay, and I just asked them outright, why have you chosen here? And the reason was, they said, we've done our homework and there is a steep curve of 50 plus year olds that will extend for many years to come that will want to holiday in the UK. So they've done their homework and chosen to invest here.
Sticking with COVID for a moment, the pandemic was a tough time for the hospitality industry. Some small businesses didn't make it through the lean seasons that followed the pandemic, and those that did have had to change the way they do business. So how far has Torbay come along the road to recovery?
I think there are signs of recovery. We're not back to where we were in 2019. But what COVID taught us was to become much more resilient and to be more creative with our product development. So out of COVID has come a significant upturn in al fresco dining, because street licenses were expanded and the government subsidised those for some time. So what you'll see when you drive around the Bay is everybody that could put tables and chairs outside has put them outside. So that means that they've extended their number of covers that they can offer. And also, so that has helped the recovery because they can seat more people. The other thing is, the huge opportunity that's come out of COVID is being dog friendly. So 40% of the staycation market now travel with their dogs. That is a post-COVID, because during COVID, if you remember, there was a figure that there was 330,000 puppies registered through COVID. So people were buying dogs, staying at home. We were all allowed out by Boris for an hour a day to walk our dogs. And it's become now, people don't want to leave their dogs in kennels. And so being dog friendly is putting you in a much stronger position to recover from COVID than if you weren't dog friendly. I remember when I started here about 12 years ago, I would say dog friendly, if you like, the percentage of holidaymakers travelling with their dogs was probably around 25%. So that's moved to 40% now. So dog-friendly accommodation, restaurants, shopping, everything is going to help those businesses recover quicker than if they're not. And I think the other thing is, you've seen restaurants and bars just think more creatively around their menus, definitely around al fresco dining. So I think food and drink is actually in a pretty strong position. We just need more visitors than we've seen in the first quarter of this year, because the weather has been so bad and so wet that the number of people that want to sit outside is nobody. So if you've only got restricted inside space, then you can only have restricted covers. But it's all about the weather.
We round off the first part of our chat with English Riviera Bid Company Chief Executive Carolyn Custerson by looking at some of the investments now being made in the local tourism offer.
It's really very exciting what's happening. And it's a sign, it's looking at the overall picture and seeing the multi-millions of pounds that are being invested is the reason I stay so optimistic. Because when you speak to the developers and ask them why here, they are so positive about this place, and they've chosen to come here rather than Bournemouth or to go to the Isle of Wight or whatever. So we're seen at the moment as a very attractive place to invest. And what's very healthy is that we're seeing a mix of private and public investment. So the Torbay Council are a strategic partner of the English Riviera Bid Company, and I have worked with the Torbay Place Board to try and secure extra government funding. We've done very well, and that will help underpin a lot of the major regeneration projects that we've all longed for, including places like Elway Mansion, and because they're just, it's so expensive to regenerate. But what's equally exciting is the public money is the level of private investment. So Splashdown, you know, £2+ million to build Pirate Island. That is a huge investment by a UK operator that's also got a water park in Poole, in Dorset. And despite the concerns around, you know, we might have about weather, because our summers are getting hotter, they're actually, you know, they've invested in this new water park, which is, so we've got the biggest water park now in the UK. So we've got so much to be really, really confident about. And then restaurants, Costero Lounge, you know, lounges have done really well. Avisto Lounge, Abbey Sands, they've been waiting for a suitable place to expand into, and they took over the Harvester in Paignton. That's been a real uplift with regard to the food and drink offering in Paignton. You've got two new hotels who, with people coming out on B&B or room only, that will be looking for places to eat and drink. My belief is there's still capacity in Paignton for more food and drink operators, because you've got, as I say, 600-700 people coming out of two hotels on a daily basis.
More next week from Carolyn Custerson on the prospects for tourism in Torbay. She'll be telling us how vital it is to have big events happening in the Bay, and marks our card on a few of those. The forthcoming air show is going to be great. The Bay will be saluting the heritage of Agatha Christie, and we'll hear why Torbay could become the new Newquay when it comes to water sports. How about that, the new Newquay? That would be quite something to have Torbay at the forefront of water sports, and there's some very interesting stuff coming up on next week's Devoncast.
Oh, I think that will be interesting, to be the new Newquay. I think there's a lot of places trying to claim to be the new Newquay, but we'll see if Torbay can live up to that. Anyway, that's us for today. I think I'm going to go off and have some lunch and start thinking about elections, Guy. I don't know about you.
I know. It's going to be pretty busy, isn't it? We've got our briefing. I'm at Exeter City Council tomorrow night. You're at Plymouth City Council, and Bradley is at the Police and Crime Commission account. Yeah. We've split it up between us. I'm expecting a very, very late night. Are you?
Yeah, I am. It's 19 seats in Plymouth, so I think that's going to take most of the night. So I'll be matchsticks on the eyes to keep me going and knocking out that copy in the early hours. But yeah, it should be fun. I haven't done an election for a long time, so I'm looking forward to it.
Me neither. I haven't done an election in the era of the internet, I don't think. The last time I did one.
Hope it all works. I got an email saying, Plymouth saying you have to sort out your own Wi-Fi, so it slightly panicked me a little. But
Exeter is far more civilised. The Wi-Fi is provided at Exeter, yeah. So we're a step ahead.
That's good. Don't forget Devoncast Radio, where you can find this podcast alongside all kinds of other local content, including the Building Greater Exeter podcast, the Torquay United Yellow Army podcast, and our rugby podcast, Two Locks and a Cox.
We'll be back very soon. Thanks for listening. Thanks for taking us on the commute, on the dog walk, wherever you did. Devoncast will be back very soon.
Catch the latest episode of Devoncast every Friday at radiox.co.uk or wherever you get your podcasts.